Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu, Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Asat tvam sho nivarateta, paroksha jnana testata, paroksha jnana testata, abhanam shani vrittisyat, abhanam shani vrittisyat, aparoksha dhyakrita, aparoksha dhyakrita. Asatva amshaha nivarateta paroksha jnanataha tatha abhana amsha nivrittihi syat aparoksha dhya krita. We're going through, this is the last reason why one might think that paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge, is Bhranti, is an error, is erroneous. So there's been this whole long unfoldment about this. And the last reason was that they're giving that the paroksha, you might mistake paroksha as being Bhranti, as being an error in terms of Brahmanism. You might say, well, just, he says, like in the previous verse, he says, say if you don't perceive something completely, when you can only perceive part of something, right? If that's so, then what you're perceiving would be erroneous because you're not perceiving the whole thing. This can be kind of the introduction to this type of thinking. But then the answer to that is, well, if that were so, if you have to perceive the whole of any given thing in order for that not to be erroneous, then even the knowledge of a pot would be erroneous. Right? Because if I hold a pot up to you, like I used the example last week, we did our last verse last week, if I hold this cup up to you, you're not seeing the whole cup. You're not seeing the back of it. You're only seeing part of it. And but yet, even though you're seeing part of it, you know it's a cup. And you're not going to say, I'm having an erroneous perception because I can't see the back of it. Right? And so here, the thing is, if you're looking at a cup and you know very well you can't see the back of it, but the fact is that this cup does have parts. Right? It does have parts. It can be divided, has a front side, a back side, an up, bottom, sides, etc. And so it takes up space. And so that's a logical question, you know, do you really know something if you can't see the back of it? You know, can you have actual knowledge of it? You can ask a question like that. But then, of course, Brahman, the self, the pure consciousness, doesn't have parts. It doesn't have a right side and a left side and an up and a down and a front and a back. There is no front and back to Brahman, to consciousness. Because with conscious being, the self, which is the Brahman, which is infinite, means Advaita, one without a second. There is nothing else but that. It has nothing to do with space. Space, air, fire, water, earth is something that comes with the creation. Just like if you have an imagination, it's not that the imagination takes place in space. Right? Space is part of the imagination. In fact, this is key to really understand this. You know, because we might think that, well, you know, I have an imagination and somehow it's taking place in space, but that isn't true. The space is part of the imagination. That's when you have if you have a dream, the space comes with the dream. It's part of the creation. And understanding that, you see that the whole creation, in fact, is like a picture, in a sense. Right? The space is as much a part of the picture as everything else. Right? And so space is one of the elements that comes with the creation. So therefore, what is the spatial dimension of Brahman, which is pure consciousness, that which is before the creation, and we'll see a verse is going to come, in the beginning there was nothing but Sat. In the beginning means before the manifestation of the creation, there was only Sat, pure being, pure existence, which is consciousness. So how big is that? How big is that Sat? Or how small? What size? Does it have anything to do with size or shape or form? See, whenever you're thinking of form or shape or front or back or parts, you have to have space. You have to have some sort of dimension so that there can this side and that side. Or even to divide something in half, there has to be a dimension, right? Or to have a front and a back, there has to be a dimension. But with being, there is no dimension at all. There is no duality. So it's simply one without a second, just pure conscious being, which is Brahman. And it is from that pure conscious being this whole creation has come. Okay. So now, that being so, how can you even think of Brahman having a part? In other words, you either know Brahman or you don't. You can't know the front of Brahman, but not the back. You can't know the right side of Brahman, but not the left side. Because it's simply one without a second. You know it or you don't. You don't know it partially. But here, Vidyaranya says, you know, that's true, of course. Brahman has no amshas, no parts at all. That is true. But even something which has no parts can have parts. And so what is meant by that? How can something which is completely free of parts have parts? What would that mean in this case? Because Brahman has no parts. So what are you talking about? Well, you're talking about the manifestation of this creation. And so now, if we're looking at Brahman from the standpoint of the manifestation of this creation, there's going to be what we call the Ajnanam and the Avarnam. Remember all of these stages, the Ajnanam and the Avarnam, what the manifestation of this creation causes. So that for the person who is ignorant, Brahman is covered by the manifestation of this creation. So you would have this is, these are all these things are, right? All of these things are. But what needs to be recognized is that the isness, which is this creation is nothing but Brahman, but you have to be able to say that. This creation is nothing but Brahman. This creation is Brahman alone. How can you say that? By differentiating Brahman from the creation. Differentiating the existence, which is the Satyam, from the Mithya of the creation. And so we can look at that in terms of parts. It's just one part is mithya, right? One part is mithya, one part is real. Now, in reference to yourself as a person here, that differentiation also needs to take place. So I'm leading into this verse here. It's something important to understand. In reference to this creation, which now this body, mind, sense organs, this person here, is a part of the creation. I'm an entity within the box of the creation. And I'm experiencing this creation. And how am I experiencing it as an entity within it? I'm experiencing it as this creation is. This creation exists. And the Upanishad will tell me that, well, in the beginning, all that was here, in terms of this creation, in of which I'm included, in the beginning, all that was here was Sat alone, was existence alone. And that existence is Ekam Advitiyam. There's a beautiful verse in the Chandogya Upanishad. In the beginning, there was existence alone, and that existence is one and non-dual. That's what the Upanishad says. So now talking to you, as one who is within this creation, is saying, this creation, you know, has for its being, has for its substance, Sat alone, existence alone. And so that, so the Upanishad reveals this as Brahman. So now the student understands Brahman is. The truth of this creation that I'm experiencing is Brahman. Okay? But now there's another amsha, there's another thing that needs to be revealed, and that is that that Brahman, that isness, that Brahman which is this creation, which is the very being of this creation, that Brahman I am. That Brahman I am. And so this Brahman that is now becomes the Brahman which I am. And so now what has to happen is, to get there, I have to go through the upadhi of this body, mind, sense organs to recognize the truth, right? That what is satyam, what is the truth of this upadhi? And I have to recognize that the truth of this upadhi is the existence, of course, which is the truth of Brahman. But how do I experience the existence? What is that existence to me? See, if we talk in third person that all of this is Brahman, Brahman is, before this could be a manifestation of the creation, all there was existence alone. Then say we move to you. You are one of the name and forms of this creation. And so, before your name and form was, Brahman alone is, right? Because your name and form is part of the creation. So, before this name and form came into being, Brahman alone was. Existence alone was. What is your experience of the existence, which was the very being from which creation came? What would that be in reference to you? The isness, which we establish when we analyze the nature of the creation and realize that all that's here is the common denominator, is just the isness. That isness is what to me? Is amness. Right? I don't say I is. I say I am. And so the definition, my experience, the way I label pure being, is I am. Because when I differentiate myself from the creation, when I differentiate myself from anything that I can objectify, what is left is simply my being. My being. How do I use that? Talk about that in language. I say, I am. How do I talk about the being of this creation using language? It is, right? But these are just words that are defining the nature of being itself, which I have labeled in language as I am, then you are, and then it is. Or we can just say being or existence. All of these words are labeling. But if I'm just saying being or existence or isness, that depersonalizes it from the I, the existence of the I. And so what has to happen is, in the whole teaching methodology itself, is that the upadhis have to be eliminated in a sense. I have to be released, the I has to be released from the upadhi of the body, mind, sense organs. Brahman has to be released from the Ishwara upadhi. So that you recognize that the self of the individual, the existent, the being of the individual, is the being of the whole. That's what the Mahavakya is, the Tat Tvamasi. You are that, right? Who is that? That is Brahman, the Sat, the being from which the whole creation has come. That is the definition of Brahman. And what is the Mahavakya? Which is the Mahavakya is the Upanishad. And this is what the vision of the Upanishad is, the Mahavakya. So the Mahavakya is Tattvamasi, you are that. You are that Brahman. Or you, that you can take it both ways. You, the individual, you, the Atma, yourself, is Brahman. Yourself is that self from which the entire creation has come. Which is how the Upanishad will define Brahman. Or, if you take it personally, what is the Mahavakya? Aham Brahmasmi. That's the Mahavakya in the form that we'll contemplate. I am Brahman. It means I am the self from which the entire, who was there, I am the one who was there in the beginning, and the one without a second who was there in the beginning, from whom this entire creation has come. That is the vision. And so here what he says is, he starts out saying, if you think there's a, this is in verse 55, he said, if you think that there's a, can be an error when only a part of something is perceived, then even knowledge of a pot would be an error, because you can't perceive the whole thing. Then the second line he says, you know, there is that state of having the samshitvam. There's that state of having a part, even for something which is free from parts. How do they mean that? He says, vyavartya amsha vibhedataha. Because of our differentiating the amsha which has to be negated. So we differentiate ourself from that part which we will negate. In another way of saying it is, we differentiate our being from what is mithya, from that which is apparent. Right? From that, we differentiate our being from that which can be negated. In your experience, everything can be negated, except for you. That's the only thing. There is only one thing that you can't negate. Only one thing, there's only, let's put it this way, which can be even more powerful in some ways. There is only one experience that you can't not have. And that is the self-evident being. You know, the self-evident experience of yourself. Not subject-object experience, just the self-evident nature of your being is the one experience that is never not there. All other experiences come and go. That's why we often don't call the self as an experience, because the definition of experience really is that which comes and goes. And we have this experience and that experience and that experience and that experience on subtle levels and on gross levels, sensory perception, experiences in the mind, all different kinds of states of experience. Experience by nature is something that is subject to continual change. But we can carefully use the word self as experience also. It's just not an experience of an object. It's the swarupa of consciousness itself. And so instead of saying experience, we'll usually say it is self-evident. But if you're not careful in talking about this, people will think, because I've heard this as an argument, well, the world is experienced. I experience the world through my sense organs. I experience the mind, I experience my thoughts and my feelings and all of that, and so I can know them, but I can't experience myself. Ever heard that? I can't experience myself, so therefore it can't be known. And so there, that's a problem, because what is happening there is then you don't recognize that the self is its own experience, because it is consciousness. It's like, so you don't have to bring in another consciousness to be conscious. You don't need another consciousness to light up consciousness. So your being, when you say, I am, I exist, me, all of these words, you're referring to yourself, which is its own light. It is the light itself. There's no light behind it or in front of it or on either side of it. It's self-evident. Or we use the word self-evident or self-effulgent, you know. And the example we use for that self-effulgence is the sun. Like you say, you don't need to bring in another sun to light up the sun. Right? It's its own light. It provides light for the whole world. It lights up the whole world. But nothing need light up it. So like that, you light up all of your experience. All experience takes place in your being and consciousness. And because of your consciousness, everything is lit up. But what about the consciousness which you are? Does something need to light that up? No, you're the bottom line. There's nothing behind you to light you up. There's nothing in front of you to light you up. You are the source. of that light. Okay, so now, this being that you are needs to be differentiated in a twofold way. It needs to be differentiated, you, the Atma, need to be differentiated from your upadis, from the body, mind, sense organs, right? So that you can be free, so that you can recognize that you are not, when this body dies, you don't die. When the mind is happy or sad, you're not happy or sad. You're the very being of that, but you're not becoming happy or sad because the mind is. You're not dying because the body dies. So that, you have to recognize that the freedom of yourself, you know, amidst this, these upadis, which are all points of identification. And then you need to recognize that the self that you are, this being that I am, is the being that you are, and you are, and you are, and is the very being that the creation is. That there is only one being, one self. And so the isness of Brahman, the existence, the sat out of which the whole creation comes. Now, if I say that, just by saying that, I've differentiated sat from the creation. The existence from which the creation comes. The existence with sat alone, it goes, I'll read the Sanskrit later. Sat in the beginning sat alone was. It's the verse from Chandogya Upanishad. In the beginning, sat alone was. And that sat was ekam eva advitiyam. That sat, that being, was one without a second. In the beginning, sat alone was. And that sat is one without a second. From that, the whole creation comes. And he goes on teaching and ends with tat tvam asi. That sat. That sat you are. But to get there, right, there's a lot of differentiation that has to take place. And so that's why we look at this as the amshatvam. There is no amsha, there is no part to Brahman. But then when we're dealing with this creation that is so many parts, and there's this problem of ajnanam, of ignorance, and the covering that that ignorance causes, then all of this differentiation has to take place so we can talk about parts there. So here in this verse he says, the asattva amsha nivartata, that part, he's taking now in this verse, if you remember when we went through in a lot of the previous verses when he was talking about paroksha jnanam, the paroksha jnanam will tell you that Brahman is, right? Until the paroksha jnanam comes and says Brahman is, or Atma, the self is, or Brahman is, until then, you'll think, what Brahman? I don't see any Brahman. There is no infinite self. I've never heard of such a thing. Why? Because you're experiencing this creation. And how are you experiencing the creation? As this is, and this is, and this is, and this is. So you're giving the isness, which is Brahman, to all of the objects that you experience. As though Brahman is an adjective. The existence is an adjective to the objects, rather than existence being the noun. Right? So, like Swamiji will sometimes say, you know, here is rug existence, and chair existence, and table existence. Right? We'll say the table is, you know, as though the isness, because there is a table, the table is. There's isness here because there's a table. Not that there's table isness. We have to see, everything has to be switched around where you see that the isness which this whole creation enjoys is a dvaita. It's one without a second. So that has to take place. And until that takes place, the sattva amsha that Brahman is, isn't there. We don't know anything about it. All we know is all these objects exist. Not that Brahman exists, that Brahman is the noun. So this asat part, nivartate, is eliminated by paroksha jnanam. Because the teacher teaches, in the beginning there was nothing but Brahman. That's the Upanishad talking. You have Shraddhan in the Upanishad. Okay? And you can go further. In the beginning there was nothing but Brahman. And you can even say that Brahman was you, is you. You won't get it, though. Right? So it's still parochignanam. But say, if I just stick with Brahman, in the beginning there was nothing but Brahman. All of this is the... But that has to, as we'll see later, that has to be unfolded, right? But that takes away, that parochignanam takes away the non-existence of Brahman. Okay, then, tata, similarly, abhana amsha nivrittihi syat aparoksha diyakrita. He says, we get rid of that part which is the not shining, the non-manifestation of Brahman. That part we get rid of by aparoksha, by the direct knowledge, aparoksha diyakrita. That is done by the direct knowledge of Brahman, the direct knowledge, the manifestation of Brahman. Okay, so think about it like this. If I say to you, in the beginning, all that there was is Sat, existence, being. And what if I even say, in fact, in this whole creation, there is really nothing here but existence, but being. This is paroksha. Because you can say, well, yes, all of this exists. I can see that all of this exists. Because actually, you do have immediate knowledge of all of it existing. You know what I mean? If you say, when you're saying, look, it is, you're appreciating the existence of all of this. I can say, even say to you, this is still paroksha, but I can say, even every thought in your mind exists. Every feeling that you have exists. Your dream exists as long as it's there. Every experience that you have exists. All of it is. Can't you see that? It is. You give the existence to all of it. You take that existence for granted. And yes, I do. Then you'll say, then what if I were to say then, but what is that existence? Do you know that existence? You would say, well, I can't see it. But what if I probably have to ask you that, or you wouldn't even think of a question like that. So I would say, can you see the existence? Can you see existence? And this would take a lot of discernment, because you would probably say, had you not been taught, you would say, well, I can see all of these objects, and all of these objects exist. It wouldn't occur to you to differentiate the existence which these objects enjoy from their name and form. Or you just see the objects are there, and you say the objects exist. But that's very fine, that's very subtle, to be able to differentiate the isness that all of these objects are enjoying from the objects. Now, you can't differentiate it, really, through sense perception. It's not possible. Because through sense perception, all you can see are the names and forms. That's what sense perception does. Sounds, you can just hear sounds, that's all. Sense, through your eyes, you can see color, you can see form, right? But you're not seeing the existence, you're seeing the form. How can you then know the existence? There's only one way, really. And that is this. If you say, in the beginning, before the manifestation of the creation, all there was, one without a second, was pure being. This whole creation is a manifestation of that alone. That is the substance. Because it's not like, see, that's also a little subtle. If you say, in the beginning there was Sat alone, and that Sat was one without a second. Now think of that. One without a second means it has no parts, there's nothing else there, there's just pure Sat. And that's all there was. There's nothing hidden, there wasn't a woodshed there, you know, with some supplies to build the creation out of. No supplies at all. That being so, this creation being a manifestation of that alone, right? There can't be anything else here. And also, that being one without a second, having no parts, it can't become, it can't move around and become the creation, right? And that's why the Maya comes in. That's exactly why Maya comes in, because that's why we say Vivarta Upadana Karanam. It's the material, the sat is the material cause. It's the only thing that's actually here. But it doesn't go through a modification to become the creation. And that's why we bring in like a dream example, or the use an example of your mind. Just like if we say, we bring in the Maya and use an example of the dream or an example of your mind, because there you have an example of your being, being the only substance that is there, and that substance manifesting as a meadow, manifesting as a dream, manifesting as a thought, where that thought has no substance of its own. It's Maya, right? It doesn't, you can project it and you can withdraw it. And so it doesn't have anything, it doesn't have anything of its own there. But when you project it, it exists. What is the existence that it's using? Is the one sat. And so that sat is the very material substance, not my material, it's the very thing, the one and only thing that is there, the very being of this creation. Now, you, all, me, are included in that creation. And so here we are within the box of the creation looking around with our sense organs. And what are we? Sat. We are sat. But what do our eyes see? Form. What are our ears hear? And hear, right? Touch, taste, smell. Because this body-mind sense organs, which is part of this manifestation, is built to participate in it. But in terms of what is here, in terms of substance, it is the one sat, which is responsible, the very being, the manifestation of the whole. And so since that sat is one without a second, and because you can't see it with your sense organs, because all you can see with your experience with your sense organs are sense objects, which are all part of this manifestation, then we have to say, okay, what is inside of this body, mind, sense organs? What is the clay of the pot here? What is the being of this body, mind, sense organs? The being of this body, mind, sense organs is going to be the being of this body, mind, sense organs and of the rug and of the whole creation in its entirety. Because all that is here is set. Now, how will you be able to discover amidst these changing parts that make up you as an individual, your eyes and ears and mind and physical body, that core material that we call sat? Well, we have to get to that which cannot be about us, which cannot be objectified. If it can be objectified as an object, it's part of the manifestation of the creation. If it can't be objectified, then I'm just to my core then. I'm to what is. You see what I mean? If you can objectify, if you can look at it, if you can watch it move around, if you can see this image and that image, if it's objectifiable, it's part of the manifestation. It's part of mitya, actually. It's part of the maya. What about me as a part of the maya? Well, first of all, what it's going to be is me, right? Like the what's the truth of the pot? It has to be the clay. What's the truth of the universe? It has to be sat. What is actually there? Now, if I look at me, this person here, who is going to be the me? Who's going to give me this sense of me, the sense of being, the one that is actually here, right? It's going to be the conscious being that I am, my amness, my existence. That is the sat. And that sat is labeled as am, I am. Why is that a problem? Because language doesn't stop with I am. It's you are, and it is. And so the sat is superimposed on every object in the creation. I am superimposed. It's a better word, there's a truth of how to say it. I am superimposed on every object in the creation. And what do we mean by superimposed? It's not like there's some sat being superimposed. It's that everything is ulta. Ulta means in Hindi, everything is opposite. Right? You know, it's as though the clay is superimposed on the pot. The clay's not superimposed on the pot. But somebody thinks that the existence of the clay is dependent upon the pot. And it's the opposite. So somebody thinks, we think because of ignorance, that my being is dependent upon the form. My being is dependent upon the perception, things I perceive. That's not true at all. My being's not dependent upon anything. It's the very ground of the entire creation. I am the very ground of the entire creation. And so I need to be totally differentiated. My being needs to be differentiated from the mithya. The satyam needs to be differentiated from the mithya, even though there's nothing to differentiate, really. Not in reality. Let's differentiate the clay from the pot. We have to do that, but there's only clay there. We have to differentiate myself from the creation, even though I'm the only thing that's here. Because there is this world, even though this world is only me. From the standpoint of sat, not from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs. And the identification with the upadhi is so profound that we have to see this over and over and over again for so many different ways. And so, when that isness becomes amness, then Brahman is becomes I am Brahman. That's the aparoksha. Then I know. I can appreciate Brahman is, but I have to appreciate that the isness, which is Brahman, is my amness. Then I have the aparoksha jnanam. So now he thinks, all right, you need to have an example. So let's try that example. Back to the tenth man. Dashamosti tivi prantam. Dashamosti tivi prantam. Paroksha jnanam ichyate. Paroksha jnanam ichyate. Brahmasti tyapi tad vatsyat. Brahmasti tyapi tad vatsyat. Ajnana varanam samam. Ajnana varanam samam. Dashamaha asti iti. Vibhrantam paroksha jnanam ikshate. Brahma asti iti api tadvat syat ajnana avaranam samam. He says, Dashamaha asti iti. That the tenth man is. Dashamaha is tenth man. Okay. Tenth. Dashamaha asti. The tenth man is. So dashamaha asti iti. That the tenth man is. Vibrantam paroksha jnanam ikshate. The paroksha jnanam, the indirect knowledge that the tenth man is seen as vibrantam, free from air. V means vigata. Brantam means air. So that the tenth, the indirect knowledge that the tenth man is, we should be seen, it is to be seen as something which is free from error, right? It is seen as, not is to be seen, it is seen as something free from error. When the old man comes up and then points out to the tenth man and says the tenth man is, and we're all bystanders watching this, because we know the whole story. Right? So he says the tenth man is, that's the truth. Right? We know it's the truth. And we know the problem is that the tenth man hasn't realized that I am the tenth man. But we know very well that the tenth man is, right? And so when the old man comes and says, don't worry, I'll help you, the tenth man is. That paroksha jnana, that is true. There is a tenth man. The tenth man does exist. So then he says, brahma asti ityapi tadvat. Like that, brahma is. Brahman is. Api brahman. Also, the statement brahman is. In the same way, that also, he says, that also is true in the same way. That also is free from error. He says, and then he says, ajnana avaranam samam. In both cases, Brahman and the tenth man are covered, have the covering of ignorance. Remember, if we look at all of the stages, there's ignorance, and then the covering of ignorance, and then the projection that that causes. Then you need the paroksha jnanam and the aparoksha jnanam, and then you get the moksha from sorrow, freedom from sorrow, and then you get the fullness of the tripti from the liberation. So he goes through all of these stages, right? So here, if I say the tenth man is, that's indirect knowledge, and that indirect knowledge is, now the covering is still, even though it's the truth, it's still suffering from the covering that is caused by ajnanam. Because now think of this, you're the tenth man, and I tell you, you are the tenth man, okay? I tell you, don't worry, the tenth man is. And you say, oh, really? Thank goodness, please show him to me. So the tenth man is true, but I have no idea that I am the tenth man because of the covering of ignorance. Similarly, what if it's the same way I say to you, you are Brahman, right? I say, don't worry, Brahman is. Really? No? Please give me that knowledge. Say, if I say in English in this way, don't worry, the infinite self is. The infinite self is. Really? Could you please show me that infinite self? Could you give me a way? Could you teach me how to gain that infinite self? Okay. That's the covering that's caused by ignorance. Yeah. So then he says, that's all there is in that verse. Atma brahmeti vakyarate. Atma brahmeti vakyarate. Nisheshena vicharite. Nisheshena vicharite. Vyaktirulikyate yadvat. Dashamastvam astityataha. Dashamastvam astityataha. Atma brahma iti vakya arte nisheshena vicharite. Vyaktihi ulikyate yadvat. Dashamaha tvam asi iti ataha. Now for the more direct knowledge. Atma brahma iti. The Atma, the individual self, is Brahman. The individual self is the limitless self. Atma brahma iti. Vakya arte. When the meaning of this sentence, vakya means sentence, artha is meaning, so vakya arte, when the meaning of this sentence, what sentence that the Atma, the self, is Brahman, when the meaning of that of this sentence, nisheshena vicharite, has been analyzed completely, leaving nothing out. Nisheshena means you leave nothing out. The analysis is absolutely complete. What? That the Atma is Brahman. What would that entail? If you're doing, for some of you who are here when we did Bhakya Vritti, it is a huge job to analyze the Atma is Brahman. Tat Tvamasi, it's the analysis of that thou art. Because first you have to understand what if I say Atma, what does that mean? If I say, you know, you are the Atma, the self, what about you is the self? Is it this body? Is it the mind? Is it the sense organs? Is it a conglomerate? What is it? That has to be established. The Atma that you are has to be differentiated from all of these upadis so that this Atma, the self, the innermost self, the pratyagatma that you are, is recognized as me. Oh, that is me. I'm not all of these upadis. Right? I have to see myself as the self of these upadis. But being the self is of the upadis is different than being the upadis. Right? I have to see the upadis as being totally dependent on me for their being, but me being totally free of them. So I have to recognize myself. That would be understanding the Atma. Then I have to go out to the creation to understand Brahman. I have to recognize that in this creation, there is nothing here. There is no, means that in all of these things that I perceive, this entire creation, I have to recognize that there is nothing here but Sat. That takes a lot of doing. I have to see, understand this whole, and understand this whole as Sat. Okay? Through teaching, through a lot of vichara, through a lot of analysis. But then, what has to happen is that I have to then, having done all that analysis, I have to then be able to say, this Atma, this self, is that Sat. This Atma is Brahman. And so, in order to be able to say that, there has to be a lot of vichara. Vichara means analysis, where my mind has to work its way through all of the doubts involved in that till it finally recognizes the truth of it without the truth of it without doubt. Without doubt means you're understanding, and then your mind, you're understanding that as the vision is being unfolded, and okay, that's clear and that's clear. But what about that? No, this all. Now, that has to be unfolded, and that's unfolded. Okay, that becomes clear, and that becomes clear. Yes, but what about that? This goes on. This goes on. That has to, all of those doubts have to be cleared so that there is no what about that. In fact, whenever any what about that comes up with the answer. Right? That means that differentiation is clear. This isn't a test. It's not like that. It's not like a test where there's 500 questions and we have to work our way through. So and then you have to memorize the answer to each question. That's paroksha jnanam. That's not going to work. What has to happen is that in this entire creation, you have to recognize as that your being is the truth of it. You have to see it. You have to see it. You have to see it. Just like the, and we'll see in this next verse, we'll get to in a minute. The tenth man, that's why it's such a good example. When the tenth man is pointed out, you are the tenth man, he could very well not believe it initially. He's going to have to go through that process of counting out the other nine. You know, just to make sure. Somebody can't just come up and say, you're the tenth man, go in peace. How high the tenth man? Looked all over for him. Right? So he has to count. But if he does, that's the vichara. And that's the vichara that leaves no stone unturned. That's the, you know, the, what word do they use here? The nishesha. There's a lot of words for this. Nishesha. Nisheshena vicharita. That means the vichara leaves nothing left out. That's why this tenth man's story, such an important part of it, is that he can't just count eight. You can't count eight of the guys. Or six. Six, okay, I get it, the tenth man is it. No, that won't work. He has to count the nine. And then the tetramasi, you are the tenth man, works. Because there's no way for the mind not to see it. There's nowhere for it to go. That's the only thing it can be. That's the only thing it is. It lands on me. There is no doubt. I have never not been the tenth man. So that's what these verses are going to say now. So here, he says, the second line here, he says, Vyakti ulikyate yedvat deshamaha tvam asi ityaktaha. He says, when the meaning of this statement, the Atma is Brahman, the Self is Brahman, has been completely, once it's been completely analyzed, without leaving anything out, then the Vyakti ulikyate. What that means is the vyakti means the actual thing that is there. So here, if I have indirect knowledge of the Atma, say somebody tells me, the Atma is pure awareness, limitless, it is Brahman. I have what we call like a Samanya Jnanam. Somebody has told me about it. I have a general understanding. That's not what we're looking for. I have to recognize that this being, which is Sat, is free. I have to recognize, that's Vyakti. The Vyakti means the actuality of myself. I have to recognize myself as I am. So the Vyakti is the particular reality of the thing. Somebody tells you, you know, yourself is existence, oh, that's good. I have a general knowledge. Ah, I am that being. That's what they mean. Me, this. That's the immediate knowledge of myself as I am. That's the aparocha jnanam. That's what we're calling vyakti here. So like that, deshamaha tvam asi. Well, just like when they say, you are the tenth man, somebody says that, you are the tenth man, having done the complete vichara, right? There's nothing left out. So he goes on to finish this. We have to go do the next verse to finish it up. Dashamaka iti prashne. Dashamaka prashne. Tvameveti nirakrite. Tvameveti nirakrite. Ganayitva snehasaha. Sorry. Ganayitva swenasaha. Ganayitva swenasaha. Swameva dashamam smaret. Swameva dashamam smaret. He says, just continuing, dashamaha kaha iti prashne. Now when there is a question comes...
Did you do the Sunday?
Oh, sorry. Dashamaha kaha iti prashne. Tvam eva iti nirakrite. Ganayitva swena saha swam eva dashamam smaret. This is continuing from the previous verse. I'll tie the two together. Dashamaha kaha iti. Who is the tenth man? Prashne. When there is the question, when the question, prashne, when the question, who is the tenth man? Nirakrite is answered as Twameva. You are. So when the tenth man, the old man comes up to him and says, the tenth man is. Okay? There is the tenth man. And the tenth man says, really? Who is the tenth man? Who is that tenth man? And the old man says, you alone are. Okay? You alone are. Then he says, Ganayitva. So now he's telling, Vidyaranya is telling the story in his own way, but it works. Ganayitva swena saha. Then having counted swena saha, including himself. So you have to supply the story here. So the old man tells him, go ahead and count, right? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. But including himself, 10. So having counted, then Swainasaha, including himself, Swam Eva Deshamam Smaret. He recognizes, you know, it comes to him now, what? That he himself is the tenth man. Right? Is there going to be any doubt? But it starts out with absolutely indirect knowledge. The old man comes and says, you know, don't worry, the tenth man is. Really, where is he? Who is he? Where is he? You yourself are the tenth man. How could I be the tenth man? How could that be possible? How could I be the tenth man? It's like, it would be the same in the Upanishads. If they go kind of backwards like Vidyaranya is doing, Swamiji will tell the story differently. But say you tell the story like this. The student comes to the teacher and says, please teach me, you know, who am I? You're Brahman, don't worry. You are Brahman. I'm Brahman? How can I be Brahman? And then the vichara begins, right? And so here, you know, here that's how he's saying, you know, when the question, who is the tenth man, is answered by, you alone are the tenth man, right? What? How can I be the tenth man? Then, having counted all of them, including himself, having done that, counted all nine, including himself, then I am the tenth man, becomes known. Right? That's the aparoksha jnanam. That aparoksha jnanam, though, where the mind completely owns that, right, without any doubt, but that when that requires clarity. Clarity requires vichara. Clarity vichara means understanding, right? Analysis, so that you see it step by step by step. Otherwise, they're just words. It's a belief. You don't see it. Self-knowledge isn't going to be something you're going to be gaining through sense perception, right? So it's something which you have, the self-knowledge that you're seeking. You already are what you're seeking. That you already are Brahman. You always have been Brahman. And you always will be Brahman. And so this is not going to be a matter of experience. It's going to be a matter of inquiry and recognition. And so since you've always been Brahman, you are Brahman, you always will be Brahman. So you go and say to somebody, please teach me about Brahman. You go to the guru, please teach me about Brahman. You are Brahman. Who is Brahman? You are Brahman. Do you see how that is meaningless? Because if that's all what was needed, you would already, it would be done. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I forgot. So that means so much ignorance has to be, we have to just go through so much ignorance. So many coverings are there. And it's not an ignorance that we created. It's a beginningless ignorance. It's ignorance that is natural to the manifestation of the creation. So we have to wade through all of that and gain so much clarity. You know, that's why teaching doesn't take place overnight. It goes on and on and on and on, because we have to actually recognize this from so many different angles until we say, oh my gosh. And when, as you see it, it's the simplest thing in the world. But it's the simplest thing in the world because it's you. But because it's you, it's the most difficult thing in the world. Because the seeker, you know, the sought is the seeker. We used to say the sought is hidden in the seeker, but that's like, you know, putting a little pea in a pod or something. It's not that the sought is hidden in the seeker. The sought is the seeker. That makes it worse. If it was hidden in the seeker, we could look around in the seeker somewhere. But that's not it. The sought, you know, the sought is the seeker. So it makes it a very good hiding place. Okay, let's stop it. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Did this tenth man story originate with Panchadasi? Did you learn that?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. I wonder.
It works.
Oh yeah, it does. But I'm trying to think of. I don't think it's in one of the Upanishads. I'm not sure. I don't think so.
But it makes it so clear when you hear that story. Just bingo.
Carol, I have this long-standing doubt about my self-experience with Brahman. Because I don't actually... I just have the experience. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know... I can't say definitively I need my mind or I don't need my mind, or, you know, I have no idea how my experience is generated, how much it goes to the mind or the body. I mean, it feels, I can't separate it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can feel something that feels like a larger home than my mind or my body, but it's very, very nebulous. So I don't know how I would answer somebody if they said to me, something like that, like, well, no, your experience, it's generated by your mind, of course. It's generated by your body, and like everything else is, you know, sort of our usual Western conception.
Right. This is why this is exactly where all of the different teaching methodologies come in. And some of the teaching methodology, they're all involve seeing, but they also involve logic. Okay, like, for instance, if I have a subject-object relationship with something, anything, say a thought in my mind, and that thing comes into being and goes out of being, so, right? It comes into my experience and goes out of my experience. There's something that doesn't come into the experience and go out of the experience, and that's the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that's so, then there is no real relationship between that which comes and goes, and that which doesn't. And so when we're analyzing my experience as an individual here to get to that which is not subject to change, we go through a process of differentiation, right, to see, okay, what stays, what doesn't. And then that's just one logic. Then from there, because what we're trying to do is not exactly prove it to you, even though the logic does prove it in a way, but the logic together with the differentiating of your own experience starts to make you see there's something which cannot be objectified, right? That is not subject to any type of modification or change amidst all of these things that are modifying and changing. And so then there's a twofold thing. I recognize that which is stable amidst that which is changing. And then I'll say, well, maybe that which is stable, could it be produced by that which is changing?
Or just experienced by that which is changing?
No, because you can't say like that, because in your own experience, there's going to be a subject-object. Who is experiencing who?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you are always going to be, if you're going to try to find out who you are, you're going to be located in the experiencer, not in the experienced. Right? So it's always going to be that way, no matter how subtle the analysis becomes.
Mm-hmm.
Your being will always be located in consciousness, not something that can be devoid of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Something that can be devoid of consciousness is something that goes out of consciousness. Consciousness won't go out of consciousness. Right? So whatever can go out of consciousness doesn't belong to the consciousness. Is that kind of starting to make sense?
Yeah.
And so it's an internal analysis of the inner space that I'm enjoying. And we have to bring in the outer space too, but initially you want to go into the inner space of what is my actual experience. And you want to find out, you know, it's the who am I question. The who am I question can't resolve in something that can be negated. It can never be resolved in an experience that I'm not having. Right? Because say, if I'm here and a given experience is not, then that experience has been negated because I can be without it. So what I have to end up in that which I cannot be without. And don't even think of it in terms of things. Think of it in terms of experience. What experience can I not be without? Because the experience, the awareness experience, the self-effulgent experience of just of being is present and pervasive to every experience. Every single experience I have, it's pervasive to it's the very being of every experience I have. But the changing experiences can be without that. Because they go away. Mm-hmm. But I don't. So I can't be without that. Mm-hmm. So anything that I can negate is away from my essence. Then you say, well, maybe somehow we go, maybe the brain is giving it to me, or the conglomerate of the body is giving it to me. Well, when we look at this, we can look at it two ways. Either we can say this is inert matter and is subject to death, right? And being without consciousness, you know? Or you can say, well, somehow still it could be producing consciousness. So we want to say that. Okay, then I'll say, all right, let's look and see if we can find something here then. If you say this is a producer of consciousness, right, that this has, then this has to have some substance away from consciousness. See, now where I'm going here. If you say this is a producer of consciousness, because we're getting into the actual physical realm of this world. This world, this physical body with the mind and all, it produces consciousness. I'll say, it doesn't produce consciousness, it is consciousness. Okay? What do you mean it is consciousness? Well, show me that it's not. Give me something here. In terms of the body or the mind, can you show me something? And you can't. Because everything that makes up the body and the mind is infinitely divisible into smaller and smaller parts. Everything that makes up the body, the mind, is something that comes into being and goes out of being. It has no being. So if you want it to produce consciousness, then I would say it can't produce consciousness because it already is consciousness. In fact, there's nothing here but consciousness. So try to find an object here. So we do use logic. You know, your mind, that's why... And we want your mind to think, which is somehow in the West, we've kind of grown up in the West thinking, you know, in philosophy you can think, in math you can think, in science you can think, but in spirituality and religion you don't think. Mm-hmm. And we even think, especially when in spiritual things, you have to shut down the mind, go beyond the mind. Okay? But that's not going to be very helpful, you know, because you already are what you seek. So whether you shut down the mind or don't, if you shut down the mind, say what you're thinking is let's totally shut down the mind so whatever's there without the mind will shine. But then what happens, and that's more of a yoga tradition, shut down the mind so that whatever is the only thing I'll be experiencing is what is beyond the mind, right? So we can have some, that's a way of trying to get to the self, some sort of samadhi experience. But the problem is, say you do that, shut down the mind, have the samadhi experience, because you shut down the mind in a way, but then the mind comes back. And the mind, now that it's back, it has to interpret what just happened. It has to make sense out of it, right? And then it makes sense out of it in all kinds of ways. Like one way would be, I just had an experience of myself. And I want to have another experience of myself, so let's shut down the mind again. You know? That's what happens. And it, all kinds of things. I mean, this is what philosophy is, you know, whatever interesting idea you can come up with. But it doesn't really help if we're still experience-oriented.
Okay. This, you know, these sections we're studying now, that I, at first I just thought these were just kind of very kind of legalistic. I didn't really get it. But now it seems like it really is explaining why the Shastra, you know, how it works.
Yes,
you know, right?
That's exactly what it's doing.
It's amazing. So it's really an amazing thing, actually, because it shows. Because most people will say that indirect knowledge or the philosophical knowledge is sort of a second-class citizen, and ultimately you should just be able to do without it and so forth. But this shows why it's you know, it's necessary.
And inevitable, also.
And inevitable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, because how is it not going to be there? How am I just going to say, you are Brahman?
With a peacock feather?
Yeah. Yeah. He's showing, you know, just how the whole thing, you know, unfolds.
How it works.
How it
so
works,
like you
yeah.
have to use the indirect knowledge of the vichara to discriminate sat from the asat. Before, really, you can then directly know the sat as yourself.
Well, you know, yeah. that's right. Yeah. Yeah. There's so many words, there's so much unfoldment, you know? And you say, oh yes, I understand that, I understand that. But all of thing has to resolve into the recognition of yourself, that you are that, you know? So there will be a lot of instances of paroksha jnanam.
And also you'd have to, you know, you'd have to have that shraddha that somebody is telling you that okay, you know, I accept that, I don't know it.
You don't know it as yourself,
yeah.
but you understand and you see it and you see it.
Right.
Yeah. And then when you see it directly, is that paroksha jnana, and you say, oh, yeah, that's what that, I do, that's right. Right? But what they've been saying all along, that is it, that's right. That's why the paroksha jnana is true. You know, because the paroksha jnana is saying, in a sense, it's saying, you are Brahman. And the aparoksha jnanam is saying, you are Brahman. But in the one, you recognize, I am Brahman.
And this sort of like also shows why the kind of Neo-Vedanta idea that you, you know, you just study the philosophy, but then you go meditate, and then you actually experience it, and then later you understand the philosophy after you have samadhi or something. This shows why that's not
why clear, that's not correct, yeah.
Why, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly. Neo-Vedanta is pervasive in this country also, that idea.
It's always experience oriented.
It is. It's to me, it's like a combination of, it has kind of a yoga component in it. You know, you listen to a lecture on Vedanta and then go try to experience it. And this is misses the whole thing, you know.
But even sometimes, you know, I think with paroksha, and yeah, with paroksha, with hearing that, like doing the driktrisha viveka, but just from my own experience for a really long time, it was like, okay, driktrisha viveka, okay, subject, object, okay, objects. Objects were very evident to me. I mean, there's no problem because they were just there.
Yeah.
But what is subject? So I realized that for a really long time, I was actually looking for the subject as if it was an object, trying to find an object that matched up to what this description of Brahman was.
Yes,
missing.
But that's right. And the reason is that's how we know, that's how the mind works in reference to the world. you have an experience of something and then you gain knowledge of it. So your going mind is going around looking for the experience. That's totally different here because the self-experience, the self-effulgent experience of my presence is already completely here. So there's nowhere to look. There's nowhere to go to look. In fact, if you're looking, you're going in the wrong direction. You know? So, yeah. So many things have to click. Almost like there's all these little koans going on, you know, these little things that all the sudden you have to see what's being said. Yeah.
And then when you see it, it's kind of like, then you say, oh, that's why they use those words.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why they say it in that. That's what they meant. Because all of these words, even, you know, if we say, like, even the word consciousness, awareness, being, wholeness, being asanga, unattached, all of these words are just words that have to land on their object, which is you. And then you say, oh, and even ananda. That's the biggest one. You know, because we, unfortunately, ananda has this word bliss. It's been translated as bliss. Everybody said, well, I don't have any bliss. You know? I don't have bliss. Because we're thinking of blissful experiences like highs or, you know, exalted states of happiness, that type of thing. That's not the meaning of it.
Something, you know, elevated.
Yeah, some elevated, happy, joyful, extraordinarily blissful experience. Not but the word is defining you, the nature of your being. And then you have to, when you recognize yourself, then you say, well, why do they call it bliss? And then you check that out. Why do they call it bliss, ananda? And then you'll see, because there is nothing more dear to you than your being. There's nothing more important. There's nothing more valued. There's nothing more cherished. It is the most beloved. That's why, you know, Rumi and all of these beautiful mystics, poets will always talk about the self as the beloved, the most dear. You know, that's because of its nature is love. But even love, you can't say any word. The words, all the words you use, like if you say love or wholeness, fullness, you know, joy. No, those words don't. Love, wholeness, fullness. The words have to land on you, and then you have to say, oh, I understand why they use that word.
How do you get those words to land like that, or to have a finer meaning to the word, you know?
Well, because they keep pointing to your being, and then you put two and two together.
<You know? laughs> Oh, that's what they mean.
Yeah. When you recognize your own me, and when you recognize that, then all of these words that have been used to point to make you have that recognition, then you say, oh, that fits. That's why they use that.
Mm-hmm. Rada, you know, I go in and out of that. You know, I recognize it, and then thoughts come in and go like, oh, no, that's not it. You know, or doubt or whatever.
Those are.
But I go in and out. It's not like, you know, oh, that's it. And that will, you know what I mean?
Well, it's what can shake you then is a doubt.
Right.
Right. But that's all right. That just means that doubt has to.
So to see that doubt.
Yeah.
For what it is, and not run with it. Because it's still it comes and goes too, though, right?
Yeah, but say if there's a doubt, then those doubts are important. Those are what you bring to satsang. Either they're being taken care of in the class. Or those are the things you bring to the class to talk about.
Yeah, because I keep using different words that you use. Sometimes I use the word I'm fullness. Sometimes I use I'm pure awareness, and everything comes and goes. I'm pure awareness in which everything comes and goes, right? So I get some clarity around that. But then to use a word like you sometimes say, I am the presence, silent, stable.
Presence. Yeah.
See, that's a lot of words for me. You know, I can really get off of that and go like, well, is that what she means? Is this what she means? Is that it?
Then
is
just
it?
Get rid of all the words except for one. Because I could say, yeah, like stable. See, you know, the Atman, one word they use is kutastha. And that can be used as the one that's stable within the Maya, but it's also a word for an anvil. Swamiji, you know, an anvil that you like if you pound iron on it, you know, to shape something. Because the self is so stable, you can't, because it's all there is. There's no place for it to go. It's one without a second. So there cannot be anything more stable than yourself. And so you can recognize, you know, when you're doing your contemplation or once you've recognized yourself, it's just that way. It's absolutely stable. Nothing can shake it. Nothing can harm it or move it or push it. So you can't push it anywhere. You know, it's absolutely stable.
What's that word again?
Stable. Kutastha.
Kutastoham?
Yeah, kutastoham. Yeah.
And then stable.
And we've done meditation. Swamiji used to do meditations like kutastoham. Yeah.
And so then stable means Brahmanishta?
No, stable in the sense, Brahmanishta means that, that's a little different. That means I'm stable, I'm rooted in my knowledge in Brahman without any doubts. The mind is completely free of doubts. There's no part of the mind that says, oh, am I Brahman or not Brahman? It's Brahman is, the, my being is that, I am that. And that's aparoksha to me completely. That's Brahmanishta without any doubt. But here I'm talking, say if I wanted to throw some, as a, say I'm guiding a meditation or something, and I'm using some words, like if I say, you are unattached, what would that mean? Asangoham. It means that the self is always there, the thoughts are coming and going, but nothing, they're not attached to myself. A thought comes and goes, I remain the same. So that means I'm unattached. No matter what mood is there, what emotion, what thought is there, I'm unattached. So I could say asangoham. Or I could say I am silence. Right? Because all of the sound is taking place, the Atma, the self, is completely silent. Because I'm the silence that illumines the sound. I'm the silence behind all of the sound. So I could say I'm silence. So those words are pointing. Now what if I say I am stable? You know, stable means kutastha. It means that there's no, nothing can move me or shake me, you know, or displace me. I'm strong, stable. So they're just words. Now say a word. You think, stable? All right, get rid of that word.
Say a word like, I'm always there.
Yeah, I'm always there.
That's a pretty direct one.
Yeah.
But
I'm always there. Means my presence, me, I'm always there. It doesn't matter what the thought, what the mood, what the emotion, I'm always totally present to that.
But there, to me, implies still over there.
Oh.
You know, I am here would make more sense to me.
Okay, that's language. Then you would say, for you, say, I am always here. See, if I say, I am always there, like probably with Durga also, I am always there, I know what I'm talking about. But say, maybe for you, you would say, that would be saying the same thing as I am always here. Means whatever thought is here, whatever feeling is here, whatever perception is here, I am always totally the center of that, the changeless being of that.
I think it has to do with English being my second language.
I was just thinking, here and there, yeah.
Dictionaries about things that are not in the dictionary.
Yeah, yeah.
What is Bill saying?
Proximity. Because your use of here is better than our use of there, but it's kind of a colloquialism also. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So you're more correct to say I'm always here. Because if I say I'm always there. Yeah. So.
Well, I'm glad that he tied these verses up. Now I have them. I feel a little bit better about figuring that. I was worried.
Right, it seems the main thing that keeps coming over and over again is the discrimination, the body-mind complex. seeing the real from the unreal.
Well, what eventually, yeah, because yeah, eventually what you want is to recognize that the stability of your own presence, that no matter what, all of these things that are changing, you need to discriminate yourself from that so that you realize this. Like in the Bhagavad Gita, over and over, it will say, realizing the akarma amidst the karma. Means the one who is changeless amidst the changing. And that's the fact of it. Amidst all of your experience, there is you, the changeless one. And the changeless one is pervasive to all of your experience, and front and center to all experience is the changeless one, which is me. So you'll see as we get into the Gita, Krishna is saying this over and over and over, the changeless one amidst the changing. The akarma, you know, the one who has no free from action amidst the karma. It, because everything else is moving.
So he said this over and over again.
In many different ways.
Arjuna, I mean, it wasn't just like...
So rather, the nebby thing, you know, this is not it. What would have more value to go around and say, well, that's not who I am. I can see this coming and go, can see this coming and going, rather than going like, I am that.
What, when you mean I am that, means like I am the world?
Or I am Brahman.
I am Brahman. We use these as devices, like we use the neti-neti, not this, not this, not this, not this. That's part of the Driksha Viveka. And that is necessary because the superimposition is so much. Because what does a person think? Is I am that, right? And so I have to realize by objectification that the self actually, right, is free of this. So that's how not this, not this, not this. Why would I do that? Because here I have this whole complex person that includes conscious being. Right? Here it is. This whole thing here includes conscious being. Includes me. So what is the Atma? What is the Anatma? What is the self? What is the not self? So we start that way. But then when we look at, is there any not self? In the end, right? First we have to differentiate the self from the not self. But then we have to deal with this not self and realize it's only mitya. Right? And so in all different ways we have to go about that. But to get to this innermost self, you have to differentiate it from the things you've misidentified. This is the anyonya adyasa, this mutual superimposition that has to be differentiated.
Which then the self becomes self-evidence, because what else is left?
That's exactly right. Yes. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Well, it seems like my biggest doubt that keeps coming up over and over is, I mean, I get this, you know, the sense of this experience of me and changeless me and all of that, but then I keep thinking, but maybe it's just the mind. Maybe it's just the mind. And if it's just the mind, it's what is the mind? Is that the brain? Well, does that mean it's just going to get snuffed out? And you know, but I think something you said tonight, I was just realizing, I'm going to see if I understand. And you're saying the question here that the mind, this is how I understand it, that the mind is just. Doesn't exist. I mean, because it can just be broken down, broken down, broken down, broken down. So
it has no being apart from.
Yeah.
It has no being of its own.
It's like the lamp in a way.
Everything's like the lamp.
Because it's just particles getting smaller, 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 and then. So already I'm sitting here thinking I have a mind, but I don't really have a mind. I mean.
The mind has its mitya, it has a relative reality, but once you go and you analyze it,
right.
It has no being. Apart from the being that it has is the Atma.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't have a being of its own. That's exactly right. And so now, say, using that, if you look at your mind, the truth of the mind is the self. That's the being. And so now, if you want you to differentiate, what in the, there's the mind which whose truth is the self, whose being is the self. The self is not changing. The mind is always changing. But the self is not away from the mind. The self is the mind. Right? It's the self of the mind. But the mind is always changing. It has no being apart from that self, which isn't changing. So you're differentiating the changeless from the changing, but the changing has no being apart from the changeless.
Yeah.
Should we go to bed?
That was great.
Wow.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.